Hey, it's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest has been called the conscience of the tech world. Her work at the intersection of psychology and technology has informed the way we think about our relationship with each other in the age of electronic devices, things like smartphones, tablets, and computers. Her new book calls us to reclaim the lost territory of face-to-face conversation. Disappearing into our phones might be easy, she says, but we lose empathy, the ability to be alone, and the chance to really know each other.
Sherry Turkle joins us now. She's a professor of the social studies of science and technology at MIT. Her new book is called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Sherry, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, while I was reading your book, it struck me that there was this section of a novel that I've read. It's called A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan that's supposed to take place in the future. You can't really tell if it's the distant future or close future, but it's a world where toddlers are the great untapped market for corporations and people don't feel comfortable talking to each other face to face. So they may sit next to each other. They may text instead of talk because it's just too much for them to converse face-to-face. And when I read that a few years ago, it seemed creepy to me, and now it doesn't seem that far off. Are we getting to the point where we're not comfortable talking to each other in depth and with attention anymore, do you think?
Well, that's what I began to explore in Reclaiming Conversation. And the reason I call it Reclaiming Conversation is that I'm optimistic that we can turn it around and the conversation is the talking cure. We're giving toddlers baby bouncers that have slots for iPads. We're giving toddlers potty trainers that have slots for tablets. I interviewed one father who said that he had an 11-year-old, and when she used to take a bath when she was like two, he would sit with her and talk to her and play with her little toys in the bathtub with her. And now he has a 2-year-old, and with the 2-year-old, he sits in the bathroom and he does his email on his smartphone. And he knows he's doing something that he doesn't like, but he does it anyway. And we're not letting conversation do the work it needs to do in order to teach us empathy, in order to get us connected. But it's not too late to turn this around.
Well, what work does conversation need to do? What is its job?
The job of conversation is to help you put yourself in the place of another, identify with the other, and let someone else have that feeling toward you. It's how we connect most fundamentally with each other's needs, feelings, life story. And, you know, you can do it through a voice. You know, by hearing inflection, by hearing, when people take a breath, when there's a lull in the conversation, we reveal, when we're pausing, when we're anxious. But it's most actually effectively done face to face, where you can make eye contact, where you can feel the closest connection. And a phone interferes with that. There's a great study that took two people in conversation and put a phone on the table between them, and immediately the nature of the conversation changes. It becomes on topics where people wouldn't mind being interrupted, on things that are more trivial. And even more important, people don't feel as close an empathic connection with each other. Even a silent phone disconnects us.
Well, you speak to a lot of people who mention the sensation in a conversation where someone starts to use their phone. They feel like they're being put on pause as people. Can you talk a little bit more about how that plays out for people in their conversations and their relationships?
Yeah, I mean, you are being put on pause. And people talk about how they compensate for it, and they begin to see it as a natural part of how life is going to be. But in a recent Pew study, and Pew is an organization that studies kind of the digital habits of Americans, 89% of adults say that in their last social interaction, they interrupted it with their phone. In other words, in the middle of a conversation, they took out their phone to do something, to check something, to check a schedule, to send a text. And 82% said that it had deteriorated the interaction. So we're doing something that we know is sort of not good for our relationships, but we're sort of getting used to it. But what I'm hearing as I did the research for Reclaiming Conversation, is that people are ready to make the corrections. People sense that, you know, we've lived with this technology for a time now, and we sense that things are amiss. And, you know, it's not too late not to get rid of our phones, but simply to put them in their place.
We're talking with Sherry Turkle right now. She's the author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. And Sherry, when people are in a group with others and, you know, say a dinner party and a couple people start using their phone, you say there's this cascade effect where then other people start using their phone and maybe there's still a thread of conversation going, but there's also this subset of people who are on their phones. And I'm wondering what you think is driving that. Is the point there for the people on the phones not to be bored, or is it not to be alone?
Well, that's such a great question. There's so many things going on here. Our phones make us three promises, sort of, that you'll never have to be alone, that you'll always be heard, and that you'll never have to be bored, and that you can, and also that you can put your attention wherever you want it to be. Whether you're in a funeral or a dinner party, you know, that you really can be wherever you want to be. And there's something about that promise, these set of promises, as though they were gifts from a benevolent genie, that we have kind of glommed onto without realizing how much they hurt our relationships with other people, the people we're with. And it's funny, one college student, when I was talking in the very beginning of my research about how I was going to be studying texting and social media, he said to me, "Professor Turkle, our texts are fine. It's what our texting is doing to our relationships with other people when we're face to face. That's the problem." And I think that really is what we need to concentrate on, is that our phones are fine. It's fun, the texting and the social media. That can be fun and fine. It's keeping it in our place so that we make sure to give our attention to the people we're with when we're with them. That's what's important.
We're talking with Sherry Turkle, a professor of the Social Studies of Science and Technology at MIT. Her new book is called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. We're talking about how our guest says we're losing things like the ability to be alone, to know ourselves and each other because we're too involved in our electronic devices.
Does that ring a bell with you? Do you wish you could engage more with people, talk more in depth? Do you ever feel like somebody put you on pause in a conversation? Or do we need to figure out how to live in this high-use technology society? Let us know what you think over at the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with MIT professor Sherry Turkle now. She says we're turning away from the most human thing that we can do, connect with each other in the act of conversation, and turning instead toward our smartphones and our devices. Her new book is called Reclaiming Conversation. And in the book, she makes the case that we have a lot to learn from boredom and solitude.
Well, let me just take... Well, first of all, the pain of boredom. Boredom is also your mind sending you a signal to go within and use your imagination. One of the great problems for kids today is that they are losing practice in going within and using their imaginations because they always have something external to go to. You want to walk towards boredom, in a sense, move towards boredom and see that moment of boredom as an opportunity, not as a signal to take out your phone. And as for loneliness, a big part of my argument in Reclaiming Conversation, and here I'm drawing on so much research by just, generations of scholars, is if you don't teach your children to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. Solitude is on the path towards conversation. It's on the path to relationship, successful relationship. You need to know who you are and have a capacity for solitude in order to reach out successfully to another person and really hear what they're saying and see them for who they are rather than just projecting who you need them to be. So boredom, solitude, a lull in a conversation, which people are starting to find intolerable. They want to fill it with looking at their phone. A lull in a conversation is when you really, someone reveals themselves to you. We used to find silence as full, not silence as some reason to go to our phone. So a lot of the things that we now code as negative are really humanly positive. And we have to make sure we don't let our phones flip things around so we, you know, we kind of turn things upside down. We have to get back to our humanity, and conversation is the most human and humanizing thing we know how to do. I think of it really as the talking cure to help us get back to these fundamental values.
We're talking with Sherry Turkle right now. She's a professor of the Social Studies of Science at MIT. Her new book is called Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. And for this book, you went to camps where there was no technology. It was sort of a technology detox camp for kids, and there are also these for adults as well. And you said this is a book of hope. So what hope did you see there about how when we do unplug and try to reengage, how easily we're able to do that?
In only 5 days at a camp without devices, children relearn empathic skills that they've lost. We are wired to be empathic creatures. And I saw kids who talked about being relearning a capacity really for solitude, relearning a capacity to take a walk in the woods, to pick up a leaf, to think their own thoughts. And I also talked to kids who were relearning the capacity to talk to other children about what the other children were feeling and thinking rather than what was on their phones.
Now, as we wrap up, you've said that we're ready to change. So how do we start? How do we begin to make these changes?
Well, some very simple things. And taken each of them alone, maybe they sound too simple, but when you take them all together, they make a difference. First, in your family, I believe in sacred spaces that are device-free. The kitchen, the dining room, the car. The car is kind. I see the car as ground zero in the fight to reclaim conversation. The driver of the car is not texting, and they can simply say, "Look, I'm not using a device as I drive. Family conversations are important to me. The car is a place where this family talks." And if you introduce that idea early enough, if you introduce it tomorrow, you know, it becomes part of your family culture that the car is a place where you play silly games, because it's in the middle of those silly games that people start to talk. And so the car, I really have seen families and get mail, so much mail about families that have used the car in this way. The kitchen and the dining room are important because one of the things that happens when kids lose imaginative capacity because they're always going to a phone is they'll say to you, "I don't know what to do." And what's nice about the kitchen and the dining room is you can say, "Hi, we're cooking. Here's what you do. Here's the knife. Help me chop this." And conversation grows up around the food preparation, around setting the table. You begin to talk about your day, and you're launched. We're not talking about complicated things here. We're talking about people having the feeling, number one, that you're there for them in a continual way. What's wonderful about family dinner is not just that it's an opportunity to talk, but that it's an opportunity to talk, and then you're coming back again. So people learn that they can be vulnerable, that they don't need to be perfect, that they're in a conversation where they don't need to edit themselves. Because one of the things that happens in online conversation is that people like it because they have the fantasy that they can be perfect, that they can edit themselves. When 18-year-old says to me, "Conversation, what's wrong with conversation? It takes place in real time and you can't control what you're going to say." You need to teach your kids that it's okay to be in a conversation where you're not perfect, that you'll be back again to have another conversation, that it's okay to have a lull in a conversation, it's okay to be yourself. So first is the notion of sacred space, and then a very, very big thing is to reclaim solitude. Reclaiming solitude is part of reclaiming conversation, because conversation really begins with a capacity for solitude, knowing yourself so that you can come to conversation with other people, with self-knowledge.
Sherry Turkle is the author of Reclaiming Conversation. You can make your pledge right now, WPR.org, and thank you.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. The Obama administration announced today that it will end its program to train moderate rebel forces in Syria, admitting that the program didn't work. The news comes as Syrian refugees continue to flow into Europe, and Russia steps up its role in the region, launching airstrikes against ISIS. Syria stands at the center of some of the United States' biggest foreign policy challenges.
Last week, in response to those challenges, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson said that he supports sending U.S. ground troops into Syria as part of an international coalition to set up safe zones. He's here with us now to talk about why he supports that. Senator Johnson, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to, Rob.
Well, last week you said you support sending U.S. ground troops into Syria. Can you describe what that mission would look like?
Well, let me be very accurate. What I said is I supported, first of all, setting up a no-fly zone so that Assad would be prevented from barrel bombing his own citizens. You know, the slaughter's already claimed the lives of close to 250,000 Syrians. And then what I said is, you know, I think the American, America has to show leadership and assemble a coalition of the willing. And the example I used was the first Gulf War, where President George H.W. Bush assembled a really pretty impressive coalition of the willing. We did supply about two-thirds of the troops for that effort, about 500,000 American troops, but there were 250,000 troops supplied by our coalition partners, and our coalition partners paid for about 85% of that effort. So again, I don't think we need an effort that massive, but I think we need is a coalition of the willing. I think the West has got to realize that this, the events in Syria are spilling out of control. We have to look at the fact that not only has Assad slaughtered 250,000 of his own people, but there are 7.6 million Syrians displaced within Syria, 4 million refugees outside of Syria, so the flow into Europe, it's just the tip of the iceberg, and we have to recognize that the events in Syria are not confined to Syria. They're spilling over. They're going to be stabling other nations, and we need to recognize the root cause of the problem really is the events in Syria. So let's stabilize Syria as opposed to having to deal with the enormous refugee flow that will only increase if we don't actually look at the root cause and solve it there in Syria.
So how would this coalition of the willing stabilize Syria? I think you had said something about ground troops from the U.S. and other countries creating safe zones.
Well, first of all, I think we have to be very overt and very vocal in terms of what our strategy is. Establish the no-fly zone, so we basically put Russia in Syria and Assad on notice that we're not going to allow you to slaughter Syrian citizens anymore. And then we very overtly, again, tell you, this is the region that we are going to establish a safety zone, a security zone for Syrians so they know they would be under the protection of a coalition of the willing. And that would be America and Western and Europe, as well as the Gulf states. So again, I think you need to be very overt in your strategy, but you have to have a strategy, which we do not have right now.
Would that coalition include Russia if they're willing to join?
If they'd be willing to join, but here's the problem is we haven't done this, and so now Russia is basically, come in and fill that void together with Iran. And so you really are, what we're witnessing right now, I think very sadly, is a strategic realignment within the Middle East. And if you really need to understand that the reality that you've got America combined with Europe, our economies, our economic strength is over $30 trillion. Russia and Iran combined is less than $3 trillion, so they're not even a tenth of our economic power, and yet look who's pushing who around. So, I don't think it's good for the world. I don't think it's for the good for the Middle East and the region to have Russia and Iran be the ascendant powers there versus the West and the Gulf states.
Suppose we have American troops and other coalition partners creating these safe zones in Syria. How long, then, does that last until ISIS is defeated, until the Assad regime is overthrown? When would the end point be?
So we haven't even talked about ISIS and the caliphate that they've established, and caliphate requires territory. We just had a hearing with FBI Director Comey and Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson and the head of our National Center Counterterrorism Center, and we talked about the fact that ISIS, the caliphate, requires territory, but as long as they have that territory, they're going to continue to inspire the types of homegrown terrorist attacks we've seen in our soil, as well as foreign fighters flowing into that region. This is a very dangerous situation, and it's a situation that we are really not addressing effectively.
But how would you like to see the U.S. do more to target ISIS while also, it sounds like, opposing the Assad regime?
We need to come up with a strategy to accomplish the goal that President Obama stated, which is degrade and ultimately defeat ISIS, and we have to defeat them sooner rather than later. You know, one of the problems we have in Syria is that President Obama, again, the commander-in-chief, president of the world superpower, demanded that it was time for Assad to leave. I mean, that's all well and good to say that, but, you know, as the leader, the commander-in-chief of America, you better have a backup plan. You better understand, well, okay, well, that's great if you ask, for example, Gaddafi to go and then assist rebel forces of toppling Gaddafi. Well, what's your backup plan? How are you going to govern Libya? I think as Colin Powell said, if you break it, you kind of own it, and we did nothing in Libya, so now we have a failed state in Libya. ISIS is infiltrating that situation. We have obviously a failed state in Syria, and of course what Russia is doing right now. By the way, they're not coming in to bomb ISIS. They're coming in to defeat the moderate opposition to Assad. They're going to bolster the Assad regime that is, again, responsible for this this limited genocide, 250,000 Syrians slaughtered. So, again, we need to show leadership. We need to assemble that coalition of the willing, or events will continue to spin out of control, and the wrong people remain in power.
But I'm hearing you say we need to step up this action against ISIS. We're already doing these airstrikes, bombing campaigns. Apart from the safe zone you're talking about, which wouldn't necessarily target ISIS, what should we be doing militarily, tactically, diplomatically even, that we aren't doing now?
Well, again, you have to take a look at the mistakes, the blunders that brought us to this very difficult situation where our options are limited. You know, we won the Iraq War, then we lost it, you know, partly because of Iranian involvement, and then we won it again, and we had a stable situation. Let's face it, President Obama, Vice President Biden said that, Iraq was a huge success, and then we bugged out. We didn't learn the lessons of history of leaving a stabilizing force behind in Iraq as the glue that was going to hold that fragile coalition together, like we did in Germany and Japan and South Korea. Those are successful models of utilizing America's economic and military might to stabilize the situation. We didn't do that. So now the situation has deteriorated dramatically, both in Iraq and Syria. So again, we can continue to let things just spin out of control. We can allow Iran and Russia become ascendant in the Middle East. I don't think that's good. You know, and I don't think it's humane to be talking about just dealing with the refugee crisis when we're not dealing with the slaughter of Syrians in Syria. So I keep going back. We need leadership. We don't have it right now. You know, I'm not in charge of foreign policy. The President of the United States is. He's not showing the leadership. And so events continue to spin out of control, and Russia and Iran are on the ascendancy in the Middle East. That's a very bad and dangerous situation. And his policy, you know, the limited bombing strikes obviously haven't worked to degrade ISIS.
We're talking to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. He represents Wisconsin. I want to come a little closer to home, to the U.S. House. Appears to be a Republican leadership crisis among your colleagues in the House of Representatives. Kevin McCarthy abruptly dropped out of the race to be Speaker yesterday. Chaos in the House, some have said. How would you propose bringing together different factions, conservatives, more establishment or moderate Republicans among your colleagues in the House?
Well, as we were talking about international affairs there and the lack of leadership, we're in a position in America where America is hungering for leadership, and we need it. We need effective leadership. And I think that the problem that the Speaker Boehner had is a very top-down leadership model, and you really do need in the House a leader, somebody who can, you know, bridge the differences between the different factions within the House conference. I know a lot of people are talking about Paul Ryan. Paul's a person of integrity. He's a person of ideas. He's a family man, which is you know, one of the real conflicts. So I don't think the House really needs advice from a United States senator other than to say we need a person of integrity. We need somebody who can really bring those factions together. We need a leader. Certainly, you know, my heart is with Paul. I've communicated with him. I told him my prayers are with him. He's got a tough choice.
And then I want to turn to your Senate race next year against your former opponent, Russ Feingold, a rematch of sorts. This seat is coming up on a lot of lists of likely Senate seats to flip in 2016. Might be a harder year for Republicans in Wisconsin during a presidential race, typically in the past. What is your plan? What's your strategy going in?
Well, I'm actually feeling pretty good about the race. I think what Wisconsin realized in 2010 is that they're looking for somebody who actually has private sector experience. I'm a manufacturer, I'm an accountant. That's a pretty valuable perspective in Washington, D.C. You know, somebody who's had a full career, you know, from the private sector, bring that lifetime experience to Washington as opposed to a career politician. You know, somebody like Senator Feingold who believes, really, he's one of the elite of America that thinks he's so smart that he can, you know, pass a law, for example, Obamacare, to tell you what kind of health care plan you need to buy. So I've got greater confidence in the people of Wisconsin to be able to make those decisions for themselves. So it's going to be a pretty stark contrast between somebody like myself who has confidence in the people of Wisconsin to make decisions for themselves versus Senator Feingold, who thinks he's so smart that he can pass these laws, that he's dedicated to growing what I think most people realize is a pretty dysfunctional federal government. I want to limit the federal government. I want to transfer governing power back to the governed, back to the state and local level where we can actually solve problems. So it's going to be a very stark contrast. It's going to be the same decision. I think Senator Feingold's challenge is going to be to tell Wisconsin why they were wrong in 2010 when they decided that he should retire after 18 years of not doing a whole lot.
You've challenged Senator Feingold, former Senator Feingold, on campaign finance issues. We presented him with some of those critiques when he was on the show. Want to throw some critiques of your campaign. Democrats have brought up again your self-funding of your previous campaign. You had spent about $9 million and then soon after the election received $10 million in deferred compensation from your old plastics company. Even if that's within the letter of the law, doesn't it look a bit like the company, in effect, bankrolled your campaign?
Not at all. What I did when I was building my business after I bought it back from the multinational corporation that I was the general manager under, I never took a salary. I invested everything back in the business so it could grow, it could provide secure employment to the people that worked with me. And so when I won the Senate race, it was time to sever my relationship. And so we went to our accounting firm and developed a deferred compensation agreement. And so I got compensated for my 13 years of running the business. And it's, you know, it's passed muster with not only the FEC but also the IRS during an audit of the company. So it was a reasonable level of compensation based on the size of the company, based on the profitability of the company. It had nothing to do with, you know, what I invested in my campaign, what I invested in America, which I think was an appropriate level as well. I was concerned about this country. I'm panicked for this country. I've been there 4.5 years. We don't have enough people that have my skill set. Understanding and being willing to recognize reality and describe the reality and tell the citizens of Wisconsin the truth about these problems we face.
Also concerns about out-of-state money, outside political groups, already seeing internet ads. One said, Russ Feingold, too liberal, too Washington, too yesterday. That was from the Club for Growth. Former Senator Feingold challenged you to sign a pledge trying to keep these groups out of the election. You haven't signed yet. Are you welcoming these groups into the election?
Well, first of all, Senator Feingold loved campaign finance reform, basically incumbent protection reform when he was an incumbent. You realize the minute he became a non-incumbent, he pretty well violated the exact principles of his own campaign finance law. He actually was proposing a law in 1995 that would have not allowed the same organization he started in February 2011. As soon as he became a non-incumbent, he would have basically prevented them from doing exactly what he's doing with that. So he set up this shadow campaign, developed a list of donors, outside of Wisconsin that it's now going to basically finance his campaign. So before I talk about any kind of badge or pledge, I think Senator Feingold has to really answer for his hypocrisy, his phoniness, in really, turning away from exactly the type of campaign finance law that was an abject failure, but violate those same principles, those same pledges that he made to the citizens of Wisconsin. So he's got an awful lot to answer for before I would even consider his badger pledge.
Senator Johnson, thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Have a great day.
That was Wisconsin U.S. Senator Ron Johnson.